This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on People Speak Radio. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of all people are needed to make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio on BBS.com, live every Tuesday night from 9 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can log into our website, thepeoplespeakradio.com, to join us live, listen to archives of previous shows, or join us in our live chat room on Pal Talk. You can listen by phone, dial 760-569-7676, enter access code 192919 pound when prompted, or on your computer or smartphone, go to bbs.com, navigate to station 2, and click the listen icon. The People Speak invites audience participation. If you have questions and comments for our guest or topic during the show, please feel free to call toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Tonight, my guest is Doris Fuller, the Executive Director of Treatment Advocacy Center. The Treatment Advocacy Center is the only national nonprofit dedicated to eliminating barriers to treatment for people with severe mental illness. I also want to preface with, the Treatment Advocacy Center does not accept funding from companies or entities involved in the sale, marketing, or distribution of pharmaceutical products. Now, with that being said, good evening, Doris. I appreciate you being with us tonight.
Good evening, Jeanette. I'm glad to be here.
Now, I'd like to begin tonight to get right into it by having you tell us what the Treatment Advocacy Center is and how it came into being.
Well, that's an excellent place to start. This is a big year for us. We turned 15 years old this year, and we were started in response to the change in laws that took place during the 60s and 70s that made it increasingly difficult to get treatment for people with the most severe mental illnesses who were not treated. So I'm talking about people primarily with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, severe bipolar with psychosis. And for a variety of reasons, during the 60s and 70s, laws became more and more restrictive so that people essentially had to be dangerous to themselves or someone else in order to be committed to a state hospital to stabilize them and give them a chance to recover. So we were founded to try to turn the tide, to turn the pendulum back to a more moderate place where people didn't have to be dangerous or commit a crime in order to get needed treatment that they were too ill to seek for themselves. So that's how we got started.
Now, prior to the Treatment Advocacy Center, we know that the laws were changed and made treatment for more difficult. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of treatment of mental illness in the USA, how it first evolved and then devolved?
And that really is what happened. It has evolved and devolved. Until the middle of the 19th century, people that had severe mental illness, people who were what we would recognize today as psychotic or delusional, were often chained up. They were warehoused, and when I mean warehoused, I mean thrown into giant warehouses where they were often kept in chains. They were jailed. They were often kept in jails. And you know, of course, even worse things happened to them. In about the 1850s, a reform movement began in America. It was led by a woman named Dorothea Dix, and some others who said, it's inhumane to treat people like this. They have an illness, and they deserve treatment. They deserve a better life. And thereupon started a wave of reform, laws were put in place that that made it possible to commit someone to treatment, and also that prevented inhumane treatment of people just because they were mentally ill. Hospitals began to be built, and so we had a huge wave of hospital building that started in the late 1800s, 1860s and thereafter, and it continued until about the 1950s. So you fast forward a century, and now what you have is a lot of 100-year-old hospitals that are in bad need of repair, that are in bad need of very costly repairs. And you have some other things going on in the American landscape. You have the emergence of Thorazine, which was really the first medication that made it possible to treat psychotic symptoms so that somebody who had a psychotic disorder actually could leave the hospital and function quite, you know, function in the community and go on and work and have a family and so forth. You also had, you know, the burgeoning civil rights movement, and there were lawyers within that movement who, after some of the first hallmarks were met, began to look around and say, you know, who else can we quote unquote liberate? And they looked at people who were in psychiatric hospitals and said, you know, these people shouldn't be there against their will. And there were financial forces. States were faced with the need to improve these hospitals. There were actually lawsuits that that said that they needed to provide treatment or let people out. And they kind of looked at these judgments from the courts and said, well, it'd be a lot cheaper to let them out than fix the hospitals. So we began what's known as deinstitutionalization. So we went from, in the mid-50s, there were at the peak, you know, I want to say 555,000 beds. There were about 300 public hospital beds. And by that, I mean beds provided by the state, because usually by the time someone is sick enough to be committed to a hospital, they don't have a job, they don't have insurance, they don't have resources, and they may very well have lost contact with their loved ones and the people who might provide help for them. So we had about 300 public hospital beds per 100,000 people, and by 2010, we had shut down enough hospitals that we had 14.1 hospital beds for every 100,000 people. That is essentially exactly how many beds we had in 1850. So we evolved to a more humane approach to the most severe mental illnesses, and then we devolved from providing hospital care. And to be sure, not everyone who was hospitalized in the 1950s necessarily needed to be in a hospital, but far more of them than get hospital treatment or other treatment are getting it today. So where are they? Well, they're in the jails, they're on the streets, they're in emergency rooms, they're committing suicide in high numbers, and they're suffering other consequences of not getting the treatment that would help them recover.
Now, as we spoke earlier, I'm aware that my state is one of those that has closed 50% of their beds just in the last decade, at a time when we seem to have a rise in the need for treatment for mental illness and evidence of the impact on a larger society. You and I had also discussed the laws, that there was a time when if they weren't dangerous to themselves or someone else, they couldn't be committed. However, those laws have also evolved with the involvement of the Treatment Advocacy Center, the Need for Treatment Standard. Could you explain to the audience what the difference is?
Yes, I'd love to actually explain what the difference is. You know, basically at the Treatment Advocacy Center, there are a number of mental health organizations on the landscape, but we're the only one that's really trying to recalibrate mental health policy, these mental health policies that began half a century ago and have brought us where we are today. So the way that, and we're talking here about, when we talk about the laws, we're talking about the ultimate safety net. We're talking about civil commitment, the laws that authorize a court to order someone into treatment, either in a hospital or in 45 states, in the community, while living in the community, they have to remain in treatment under a court order. So the civil commitment laws establish the standards under which you can do this. And sometimes you'll hear people say, well, you know, these laws just allow anyone to go out and pick up anyone. They could, you know, I'm a little bit depressed every once in a while. They could come and get me. It doesn't work that way. Each state sets its own standards. And they run the gamut. So you still have some states that are pretty much a sheer dangerousness state. Maryland would be an example of that. You essentially have to be dangerous to yourself or others to be hospitalized in Maryland. Then you have other states that say, well, we don't want to go that far. You know, we want to provide a safety net for people who are gravely disabled. And that's a term they use. They define it differently in different places. But basically, it typically covers things like perhaps someone who is psychotic, homeless, sleeping out in the cold. So they're so disabled they can't seek shelter, they can't seek food. They're not an immediate danger to themselves. They're probably, unless they're in Michigan in January, they're not going to die overnight. But they are going to continue deteriorating. So they are considered gravely disabled. And then on the spectrum, in the states that are what we regard as the most progressive, they also have what we call need for treatment standards. And basically, a need for treatment standard looks at the person and says, they may not be, you know, sleeping in the snow with no clothes on. They may not be threatening themselves or someone else. But they clearly need treatment because without it, they will deteriorate to a far more dire condition. So in a need for treatment state, they'll look at someone, say, who has, and typically these standards require a history. We're not talking about someone even with a first episode of psychosis. We're talking in most cases about people who are what's called revolving door patients, people who are repeatedly hospitalized or repeatedly jailed, or who have been picked up so many times off the streets because they are not taking care of themselves that the police know them by their first name and they know the police by their first name. And so in this case, what you get is, you know, a judge will look at this person and he knows they've been hospitalized 5 times in the last 2 years. He knows that after each hospitalization, they come out, they go off of their treatment, they deteriorate so much they end up getting picked up by the police and jailed, or they end up sleeping on the street until they're desperately ill, or they end up in the ER. And so in a need for treatment state, the judge can say, you know, this person has a history of deteriorating to the point of not being safe when he or she isn't in treatment. They're not on their meds. They're clearly deteriorating. They've been picked up by the police or whatever has brought them to the court's attention. This person needs treatment. Let's get them treatment before they get worse. So that's kind of your spectrum from dangerousness at one extreme, and I wouldn't call need for treatment as an extreme. I call it the ideal. And about half the states have need for treatment standards. The other half have a mix of standards but don't go that far.
Okay, now, Doris, the other thing I wanted to talk about, because it was only in the last few weeks that I've discovered that my state is indeed a need for treatment state, even though in my grandson's situation we've been dealing with deteriorating mental illness for almost 5 years. We've had case managers who've actively indicated that short of the clear and present danger to himself or others, there was nothing they could do. And from what you're telling us, that the need for treatment tells us, again, given the long-term deterioration, there was things they could do. Are you finding, or is there evidence that even where the need for treatment standard is the law, that there's people working within the system that are not utilizing it or aren't aware of it?
Jeanette, you've homed in on a huge problem that we have that we have in this country today. We do have the Treatment Advocacy Center and champion lawmakers and others with family members, and many people have worked together to improve the laws. But the laws, the laws are not being used the way they could and should. For example, and there's so many examples. You mentioned your grandson. We get calls from people in need for treatment states, as well as other states, who are running into the same problem at various levels. Maybe they get to a courtroom. They get as far as the courtroom. And then, in fact, I was with a family just Friday out in California who were telling this terrible story that their son had been hospitalized 9 times or something. His psychiatrist came to court. His caseworker came to court. He had the system on his side saying, this young man needs help. He needs it now. And the judge said, I'm not going to take his freedom away. He's free to go. So at some level, so you have lots of levels of the system. At one level, you have judges out there who either don't really understand the law or who are philosophically uncomfortable with it and are loath to actually use the law. So there's a real need for judicial education about these laws. Come down another step and you have, again, you have prosecutors. You have a lot of people in the criminal justice system who aren't fully aware of actually how robust and useful the laws can be. So now step back another step, and you have police officers. These are our first-line mental health workers in America today. Police see more people with severe mental illness probably than healthcare providers. They're out on the streets dealing with them every day, and it's not just the homeless. It's not people who are violent. It's people in homes where family members are desperate because their loved one is maybe even, you know, they're frightening or they're suicidal or they haven't eaten in 10 days because they're afraid their food is being poisoned. The police get called in. But we published a survey in late 2011 of about 2,400 law enforcement officers nationwide. And when asked, why can't you get treatment? Why don't the people you're called out because of, why are you not able to get them to treatment, to a hospital, to a doctor? The biggest answer they gave is, oh, well, the laws won't let us. And that answer came in states where the laws were very progressive and gave them a great deal of authority to get someone to a hospital, at least to be evaluated for whether they should be cared for. And then you get, you know, you step back another step and in you look at a situation like Colorado where James Holmes shot and killed and wounded so many people in Aurora. Colorado also has a progressive law. He also had a psychiatrist. Campus police asked the psychiatrist if they should pick him up and take him in for an evaluation. So now we had police officers who understood that there was a capacity to have this young man held involuntarily long enough to assess his psychiatric condition, and the psychiatrist didn't feel that was necessary. So, and then of course you have Arizona and Jared Loughner, where the school knew full well that he was extremely ill and simply kicked him out of the school and said, don't come back until your mental health problems are taken care of, instead of doing what could have been done, which was reporting to the mental health authorities that here was a young man who needed help, because again, Arizona had a law that would have helped. So the system, we're breaking down at lots of places. We're breaking down at every level in terms of taking care of these people, taking care of their families and their communities. And we could speculate, we could talk all night about why is this? Is it because they're voiceless? Is it because by the time they're psychotic, they're not very attractive? They're not poster children for rescue? Is it because people are frightened or just ignorant? There are probably lots of reasons. But they're not being taken care of. And the system is breaking down at virtually every point that where they could be taken care of. Not everywhere, but it happens way too often, as it's happened in Michigan with you and your family.
Yeah, and the treatment for Treatment Advocacy Center, you can find the various topics that Doris and I are discussing tonight at the treatmentadvocacycenter.org website, the various reports, the jails versus hospital reports, which I want to cover just briefly before we go into the next one. The number of people in jails at the present time as opposed to the number of people receiving appropriate treatment, again, across the nation is very variable because these laws are governed state to state. Could you give us some idea of what kind of numbers we're looking at here?
Well, we tend to, one of the things the Treatment Advocacy Center does is we're often the only organization, including government agencies, that are looking at issues that involve people with severe mental illness. So, for example, we have a study coming out in September about justifiable homicides, which is the technical term for when a law enforcement officer shoots someone in the line of duty. The government doesn't collect data on the role of mental illness in these shootings, and officers will tell you that mental illness plays a huge role. So we find ways to research and tease out numbers because we feel that the more the public is aware of the problem, the more motivated they and policymakers will be to do something about it. So jails and the jails and the criminalization of mental illness is something that quite a few people are talking about. Many people are talking about at this point, including people in law enforcement who are at wit's end about serving as mental hospitals. So our latest calculations are, well, we put out a study in 2010, which you referred to, more mentally ill persons are in jails and prisons than hospitals, which compared how many hospital beds there were for people with mental illness versus how many jail cells there were. And what we found was nationwide, someone with a severe mental illness was about 3 times more likely to be jailed than hospitalized. And that varied a lot between states. So the worst state, as I recall off the top of my head, was Arizona, which went on to make headlines. And nearby was Nevada. I guess Nevada was actually a little bit worse. But they were both jailing about 10 times as many people with mental illness as they were providing hospital care for. So nationwide right now, we estimate, and this is probably a conservative estimate, that 20% of all the inmates in jails and prisons have a severe mental illness. That comes to about 416,000 inmates right now. I have seen far higher numbers. I have seen numbers from specific sheriffs or specific agencies saying that up to half of their inmates have a severe mental illness. There are counties and states that are building mental hospitals inside their jails because they have so many people with mental illness and they can't safely incarcerate them. You know, our position at the Treatment Advocacy Center is, why don't we provide some treatment for them outside of the jails before, basically what happens is their behavior, their thinking is so disordered and their behavior is outside, you know, is they engage in criminal behavior and then they end up in jail. It shouldn't work that way. If we have the money to build hospitals for them in jail, we ought to be able to get some beds and some treatment for them out of jail. And that's not just hospital beds, Jeanette. I mean, we can also talk later maybe about court-ordered outpatient treatment, what we call assisted outpatient treatment, because not everybody needs to be in a hospital. most people with severe mental illness don't need to be in a hospital, but they may need help at some point along the way staying well enough to be out of a hospital or bridging from the hospital back to the community. And, you know, there are laws that provide this too, but they too are being underused. But basically, jails and prisons, looking at about 400,000 people, the situation in solitary confinement is much worse. The estimates I've seen, and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, does a lot of research on the condition of people with mental illness in jails and prisons. I believe their numbers are that about a third of all people in solitary confinement have a severe mental illness. So now you take someone who has a brain disease. Their thinking is disordered. They may see and hear things. They may be paranoid. They're suffering. They're actually quite tortured. If you've ever spent time with someone psychotic, you know how tortured they are. And because the jail can't, it's not safe to the other inmates or the guards or the person themselves to be in a general population, now they're locked up alone in a room for 23 hours a day, where often they're not given any form of treatment. They're not required to take medication. They may be seen 10 minutes a month by a psychiatrist if that. And so as bad as the jail scene is, then it gets, you step into within the jails and look at the treatment of people in solitary confinement. It's really back to pre-Dorothy Dix days.
Okay, Doris, at this point we need to take a short break. I want to remind the listeners this is the People Speak Radio broadcasting on BBS.com Internet Radio.
Got questions? The library has got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
This land is your land. Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak, live on BBS.com Internet Radio. Again, I'm Jeanette Lafevre with our guest, Doris Fuller, Executive Director of the Treatment Advocacy Center. During this portion of the show, you can call in questions and comments for our guest toll-free in the USA and Canada, 1-888-429-5471. Now, Doris, when we left, I had intended to go directly into a topic, but I've been informed on the break we have a caller waiting. She's a psychiatric nurse. Don, if you put the caller on, I lost the name. You should be willing to introduce herself.
Yes, hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Jeanette. Yeah, I was actually a registered nurse in Oregon and in Canada, and I've written 3 books and stepped out of the paradigm of nursing, but because of the drug therapies and looking at the drug therapies, and especially in the psychiatric field of labeling and drugging our kids, when you start them on all of these precursors, and even, you know, right away, immunizations also, too, you're starting to tell them they're just not okay and they need these drugs, and, you know, you're just, and then they're labeling, you know, toddlers, and the coping skills on our planet are a mental health issue that is way beyond just the old mental health care situation that you're talking about. It's, you know, the drugging and labeling and street drugs, that they're all intertwined, and I just wanted people to be really aware that there is a medical hypnosis insurance code which got put into place in the 1990s, and it's just like the green energy and renewable energy programs that are there, and solar and what have you, renewable energies that have been bought out by the large corporations. Well, Big Pharma, as you must be aware at this time, what it's done even with the drug and alcohol counseling programs where they try to get people off street drugs and put them on pharmaceuticals is insane. One of my shaman friends just laughed hilariously, like, yeah, that's really going to help people heal. So, you know, there are these healing modalities. There is an insurance code, like I said, for medical hypnosis, which is already healing moderate to severe psychiatric disorders, cancer, autoimmune diseases, pain management. They're working with autism, dyslexia, allergies, pretty much everything they give drugs for, but especially the psychiatric realm in children all the way through to adults. Like I said, there is an actual insurance code for it, moderate to severe psychiatric disorders, and getting people off the drug therapies with all the harmful side effects. So just taking this into another venue, what I've been working on is developing, because of our coping skills with labeling and drugging people and drinking and street drugs and violence and guns, you know, with the free education and paying for armed forces, free education,
okay.
And benefits for armed forces. Okay.
Can I interrupt you here so that we can have Doris address your concerns? Because bear in mind, okay, when we're talking about these need for treatment standards, we're talking about the seriously at-risk mentally ill. Doris, did you want to address what the guest was speaking to?
Well, you know, one of the things I get to do as the executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center is to meet with and be briefed by and associate with some of the people doing research in severe mental illness, psychiatric diseases. One of the people who's always very impressive is Dr. Thomas Enzel, who is the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. And I've heard him talk about, I've actually heard him say that the state of our knowledge about the most severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder is both on the causes and the treatment is about 30 to 40 years behind what our knowledge is on, say, strokes and cardiac disease. But one of the interesting things that they're beginning to look into is the concept that that a disease like, say, schizophrenia, once someone is actively psychotic, they're really at the stage four of a disease that started most likely prodromal symptoms, the early or the preceding symptoms that started maybe 8 or 10 years earlier. And they're doing research where they sort of break the progress of some of these diseases into stages. And the reason they're really diving into this is that they really want to be able to identify, especially adolescents, because the most psychotic disorders, these severe mental illnesses, manifest between 16 and 24 with a real peak between 18 and 22, right in the college years. And what they're trying to do is go back and begin to be able to identify these kids long before they develop symptoms. There's some interesting things going on with computer programming that they're finding that children, young people who are at risk for these diseases have some executive function involvement, and they are actually developing some computer games that will kind of target the areas that seem to be involved when schizophrenia develops later. So, like your caller, we take no money from Big Pharma because we feel as advocates for treatment, which often does include medication, it would be a conflict of interest to accept any donations from the pharmaceutical industry. But we also decry what we feel is the over-medication of young people. But our specialty, Jeanette, what we really focus on is kind of those people who've already reached stage four. There's a lot of research going on, and there's a lot of focus on helping people before they get there. But once they get there, once this person is separated from reality, what do you do for them? So we've talked a little bit about making it possible for them to get acute medical care, which is hospitalization. When someone has a heart attack, if I had a heart attack, I want acute medical care. I want to be taken to a hospital. And that's what we want for someone who's having an acute psychiatric issue. But that's not the only level of help. So we can talk about that, or if you have another question, we can go there.
Yeah, I didn't really disagree. I'm actually developed Soul, S-O-U-L, Energies Research and Development. You can look about it. Look it up on my website, angelencounters.net. And I've worked with a lot of severe kids that have been actually hospitalized over four times and then take them and do soul therapy work with them. And it's a whole new transformational programming. And it's a whole new dimension of soul therapy, mind, body, soul. And it goes even beyond any medical hypnosis programs. And it's absolutely incredible, and it turns out that a lot of why everything that they're having problem with on an emotional state will be revealed to them, and it's absolutely incredible.
Ma'am, I'd like to interrupt here because we do have a limited time frame tonight, and Doris has worked well outside her regular business day to be with us tonight, and we do have some other topics that we need to get to. Our concerns about the over-medication are reflected across society. And as Doris had said, and as I prefaced the show with, they don't accept funding from pharmaceuticals. It does create a conflict of interest if you're advocating for treatment and you're taking funding from a particular group that has a financial interest in that treatment. Now, Doris, one of the things you had pointed out to me, and I went back and looked up, was the recent New York Times series on the treatment of mental illness and the commitment standards there. And we were also talking about your new report due out tomorrow on the crisis intervention teams, both mental health and police crisis intervention teams. So if you could work us into that.
Oh, that's a great segue, Jeanette. The study you mentioned in New York was looking at what we call assisted outpatient treatment and what it costs. So assisted outpatient treatment, which goes by lots of different names in different states, it's like everything else. It's very kind of balkanized that way. So it might be outpatient commitment orders, or it has many different names. But basically what it comes down to is a program under which a court can order someone to stay in treatment as a condition of living in the community, and that treatment includes binding the treatment system to the person. So they are getting caseworking, and they are getting clinical support for their recovery. So court-ordered treatment, and again, the civil commitment laws determine who receives, who participates in an AOT program. We call it AOT for short. So the New York, the study that was out was released about 2 weeks ago, publicized in the New York Times and elsewhere, looked at what does it cost to run this program of having people with severe mental illness living in the community under a court order to stay in treatment. And frankly, the fear of or the excuse of cost is one of the big reasons that these laws, which exist in 45 of the 50 states and in the District of Columbia, are not widely used. Agencies say, oh, it'll cost way too much. Well, a team of researchers led by Duke University took broke down what it is costing to provide AOT services, which include an array of outpatient services from therapy, I believe there's some housing services, an array of things. What it court hearings, providing them with a legal representative to go into the courtroom with them. They looked at all of those costs. Then they looked at what New York City and five populous New York counties are saving by having these people stay in treatment in the community versus doing what they had been doing before they were on AOT, which was get rearrested, get rehospitalized, be victimized, be homeless, and similar consequences. What they found, and they weren't looking at every cost. For example, they did not factor in jail costs or jail savings. But in the parameters they looked at, they found comparing a specific group of patients before they were on AOT, and after they were on AOT following a hospitalization, so they were released from the hospital on orders to stay in treatment in order to keep living in the community, the city of New York saved 50% from before AOT to after AOT. The five populous counties saved 62%. The researchers said the savings were so extensive that these communities could actually provide more mental health services to more people with the savings they were making by providing these court-ordered services to people who qualified for them. We currently have another cost study going on. These are sort of slowly filtering out and into the public policy sphere, but we found this very exciting because it quantified what common sense tells you. Common sense tells you it's a lot cheaper to have someone be stable, able to work, not living on the streets, not in jail, than the reverse. Now, the study that actually, this is the first time I've talked about it because it's just being released tomorrow morning on our website, which is Treatment Advocacy Center. Actually, it's treatmentadvocacycenter.org. We also have a separate website called tacreports.org, where we publish the jail study you mentioned, Jeanette, and also our hospital bed study. So our most recent reports are at tacreports.org, but we'll publish this one both there and on our main website tomorrow. And what it looks at is, in the best of all worlds, people who are acutely ill or chronically ill would get treatment before they enter the criminal justice system. The reality is the hospital beds aren't there. AOT is not being used as widely as it could. So many people end up being a police call. How can we divert those people out of the criminal justice system? How can we stop the jails from being the biggest mental hospitals in America? The two most basic diversion tactics that are ready on the shelf for cities, counties, and states to use are CIT teams, crisis intervention teams at the police level. These are officers who receive special training on how to interact with someone who has disordered thinking, is psychotic, is a danger to themselves at that point, possibly a danger to someone else. So these are officers who learn to recognize the signs of mental illness as opposed to someone who's actually has violent intent. Maybe the person is really just trying to protect his community from aliens. I know a young man who's in prison today because he was trying to protect Flagstaff, Arizona, from aliens. So they are able to distinguish the difference between someone who's suffering these delusions and someone who is actually an aggressor and respond to them a little differently. Studies have found that CIT teams are very effective in diverting people away from the jails and into, you know, typically the course is, you know, through the hospital diagnosis. They may not stay in the hospital long, but at least they get them into a safe medical setting for their medical condition in the crisis. Mental health courts are kind of the next step down. Somebody did end up committing a crime. They got arrested. Now they go to court, and the judge looks at them, and it's a nonviolent crime. It's associated with their mental illness. People with mental illness mostly get arrested for things like trespassing, vandalism, vagrancy, nonviolent offenses. They sometimes run amok of three strikes laws, so they get arrested for three fairly minor things, and now they're sentenced to jail for the rest of their life. So the judge looks at this person and says, you know, what this person needs isn't jail. What this person needs is treatment. And so the person is essentially sentenced through mental health court to treatment. So they don't go to jail. They stay in the community. And now it depends on the state. Maybe they're required to go to group meetings four times a week. They're required to meet with their caseworker. They're required to get therapy. In other words, they're required to get treatment. Again, mental health courts have been found to reduce incarceration and to give people who are acutely ill a chance to get on the road to recovery. I mean, basically, some people are opposed to involuntary treatment because they say everybody has a right to choose their own treatment. We say that to limit treatment to those people who are well enough to choose treatment discriminates against people who need a helping hand to get to the point where they start treatment. So AOT can help them, hospitalization can help them, judges, a criminal justice system, police officers, community members, neighbors, family members, who mental health workers who work together to divert these people from criminal justice, from the streets, and help them get the treatment they need when they need it, is what we're all about.
Okay, so in the past, we have a situation very much of that penny wise, pound foolish. The savings are an illusion. And I have the report in front of me. It says $500 billion a year already spent in services to the mentally ill that is not a comprehensive treatment program, and that's more than we spend on Medicare in the last same fiscal year. Now, the other thing you addressed was the crisis intervention teams from the police department. I can speak specifically to a situation in Michigan. You know, we all heard the names Adam Lanza and Jared Loughner and saw the failures there. What we less often hear nationwide news are cases like Milton Hall, a man who the police were called by the family. He was having a psychotic episode. He was confronted by the police. He was waving a knife because they were coming at him with dogs. And he kept telling them, get your dogs back, get your dogs back, waving the knife. Now, this entire thing was captured on video. And as soon as he moved out of the view of the camera, the police pumped 46 bullets into the man. They weren't close to him. He wasn't physically trying to approach or attack them, but they didn't know how to de-escalate or talk him down. Doris, tomorrow I want to send you a link to an article a friend sent me from Australia regarding their training program, and the title of the article is When the Police Get It Right, in dealing with a similar situation with a psychotic individual they needed to take under arrest for a very serious crime. So these issues are things we're already seeing across the nation. Again, when there's innocent victims, it's all over the news, but when the victim is the mentally ill person itself, and this, as a grandparent, is my worst nightmare, is when the call comes from the police, they found my grandson, and yeah, we had to shoot him to take him down. Is as big a fear as that, I don't think people outside can understand.
I think you're right.
Go ahead.
No, I agree. And I, you know, one of the things you'll hear whenever there's one of these well-publicized episodes of someone with mental illness committing a violent act, you know, there's a lot of concern that talking about this stigmatizes, talking about the link between violence and untreated severe mental illness stigmatizes people with mental illness. You know, our approach to that is, well, let's get to the root cause. Let's treat people so they're not at risk to commit these acts. But another comment that you'll often hear at a time like this is people with mental illness are more likely to be victimized than to be victims of violence than to commit violence. This is absolutely correct. And this is just another one of those little hidden consequences that so many people are unaware of. But, you know, we'll have our report out on justifiable homicides in September. But the police-involved shootings are just a fraction of the episodes where someone with mental illness, because they are vulnerable and because in some cases, you know, in the case of 200 and a third of the people who are living on the streets, they're living on the streets. They're in a place where they can be assaulted. They can be raped. I lived in Denver a few years ago, and there was a set of young kids that were kind of roaming around looking for vulnerable homeless people and beating them to death for fun. People with untreated mental illness are not in a very good position to protect and advocate for themselves. And those of us, and I have a loved one with a severe mental illness, those of us who do constantly live in fear of what can happen to them. They're far more likely to fall victim to others than for others to fall victim to them. And part of that is also suicide. I mean, I think whenever we talk about violence, we need to remember that the most common form of violence involving severe mental illness is suicide. The rate of suicide among people with schizophrenia is about 15%. Bipolar, I believe, is 12 to 15%. We're talking rates of suicide that are about, I believe, 40 times what occur in the general population. This is a terrible loss of life that can be prevented. And when we talk about, quote-unquote, violence and mental illness, we have to remember that this is taking an enormous number of lives every year.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time here tonight, Doris, and there were so many other topics I had wanted to get into with you, things like the shorter lifespan in the United States for the mentally ill, on average 20 years less than the general population. The lack of treatment is taking a terrible toll in a lot of areas. So what I want to sum up with is I recommend that people check out the treatmentadvocacycenter.org website. The information we've discussed here has been compiled there. The reports that we've discussed are available there. It also gives a lot of information on how you can find out what's relevant to your state. These laws vary from state to state. It's very uneven nationwide. Find out what needs done in your state and address what you can be done. Also, the Treatment Advocacy Center provides information on how they can help you advocating within your state. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that before we close up for the evening, Doris?
No, Janetta, it's been great talking to you. I think the one last thing I'd add about the website is we have a section called Get Help. So if you're a family member with an ill loved one, if you're in a psychiatric crisis, we have a mobile website with information about what to do in an emergency. You can find all that in the Get Help section of our website.
Okay, well, Doris, I do want to thank you again for extending your very long day so that you could be here with us tonight. I hope that the listeners got some information that can be helpful, and we can carry out the work of the Treatment Advocacy Center by advocating for the mentally ill, each within our own community and state. So to all the listeners, good night from the People Speak, and thank you.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office of summer people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.